Hello, listeners. Just wanted to let you know that part of this week's episode deals with rape and sexual assault. If that's something that you might find upsetting, you might want to skip that part of the show. It's between 23 minutes in and 30 minutes in.
Hello, listeners. We're back with another episode of your favourite topical European podcast. I am Dominic Kramer, the Amsterdam half of this podcasting team, and I'm speaking to my good friend Katie Lee in Paris, the other half of our empire. How are you doing over there?
I'm doing very well. How are you? Are you actually in Amsterdam? I thought you were in Germany.
I am in Germany for the summer, but I've come back for the weekend because I've got another show here. But you've got an exciting week ahead of you, haven't you, Katie?
I have indeed. By the time you hear this, listeners, I too will be in Germany, in beautiful Aachen near the Belgian border. I'm going up there for the Charlemagne Youth Prize, which is the prize that we got nominated for. We are representing the Netherlands.
Don't laugh.
I'm not laughing. It's just because it's a bit awkward because I'm like British. I live in France. And I'm going to have to go there and be like, yep, I'm here as the Netherlands. But that's fine. I think that's a beautiful part of the European project. Dominic and I are technically still young people at 30, but I think most of the other people there are going to be like 18 and full of enthusiasm for life. So that's going to be fun. But no, genuinely, it's going to be a great few days meeting young people from all around the continent doing cool things. And we might win some money, quite a lot of money, actually, if we come first, second or third. So fingers crossed, I will report back next week.
Oh my God, I really hope we win.
I think we should probably work on the assumption that we don't win. So I was going to suggest, to cheer us up in advance, can you please, listeners, maybe leave us a review on iTunes to cheer us up afterwards, because we're going to need some moral support.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't win, I am blaming you, Katie.
Why is it my fault?
Because you're going, I'm not going.
This all apparently got decided a couple of weeks ago, so nothing I can do can stop us. Although I shouldn't say that, because I might then go and do some terrible things like dancing on a table, Bulgarian style, as talked about last week.
I mean, not all the Bulgarians dance on tables, Katie. You should clarify that if people didn't hear last week's episode.
If you didn't hear last week's episode, go back and listen to that, because it is a riotous tale of a youth event gone spectacularly wrong in Bulgaria. But no, I'm sure it's going to be very well behaved. No dancing on tabletops, just...
You joined the WhatsApp group, didn't you?
I did.
Of all the winners. Have there been any messages?
Just people saying hello, really. But that's really cool. There's people from Germany in there, people from Italy, all sorts of people. Are you feeling a bit left out?
Yeah, I might join just to like be a voyeur.
Oh, that's creepy. You don't belong. He doesn't go here.
No, apparently I don't. Anyway, coming up, we have two great interviews for you. First, we'll be talking to the king of the European betting market, Daniel Gould, who also just happens to be my old politics teacher from school.
Weird.
He's in Lisbon currently watching the rehearsals for this week's competition. So we'll find out how difficult it is to make your living from speculating on the Eurovision Song Contest, or perhaps how easy it is. I don't know. Maybe this is how we're going to get rich, even if we don't win the Charlemagne Prize. Anyway, we will then be hot-footing it over to Spain to speak to the writer and activist Brigitte Vassallo about this pretty awful case, what's been dubbed as the Wolfpack case. But I don't even think maybe we should be using that term, because it kind of sensationalizes it. But this awful case that was essentially a gang rape, but has legally not been counted as a gang rape.
It's a really horrible case, but it sparked this whole national debate in Spain about women's rights, and we thought it was really important to talk to one of the leading voices in Spanish feminism.
But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good Week, Bad Week.
It's everyone's favourite mini feature, apart from the other one.
Happy ending.
Yeah, isn't that everyone's favourite mini feature?
No, I think actually people might be preferring Good Week, Bad Week.
Don't know why. Anyway, it has been a good week for peace in Spain, and in Europe in general, I think. The Basque separatist movement, ETA, who have been fighting an insurgency in northern Spain and southern France for decades, have finally called it quits. They have been fighting for an independent Basque country in the border area since 1959, and they'd killed more than 800 people since then, including a prime minister. It wasn't a huge surprise that they announced that they were disbanding. They'd been getting weaker for years and years, and a bunch of their top leaders had been arrested, and they'd started giving up their weapons already. But this is it. It's finally over. And it's a quite big moment, I think, for Europe in general, because this was the last armed insurgency still going on in Western Europe. Obviously, in Northern Ireland, there's a peace process going on now, And in Corsica, that's another example. The armed separatists there announced a couple of years ago that they were going to try and fight their cause through the ballot box instead. And it's kind of interesting because it's not like separatism is dead in Europe. Like, obviously, there are still loads of people who want independence in Catalonia or in Scotland. But it feels kind of like, finally, after decades of groups like ETA fighting for separatist causes with weapons, they've slowly been realizing, maybe bombing isn't such a great way to convince people to the cause. So now we're going to have to wait and see what happens to the cause itself, to the Basque independence movement, now that ETA's gone. There's still quite a lot of people living on that French-Spanish border that still want to have their own country. They speak their own language. They have their own identity. And separatists currently make up the second largest group in the local Basque parliament. So we'll have to see what happens next.
I feel like a little bit funny about putting this in the good week. Obviously, it's good news that they're not going to fight anymore. But I watched a video with some relatives of victims saying that they were kind of, they just didn't think it was right that the world got to celebrate this when they were still mourning the loss of their family members, and that these people still haven't been brought to justice. And I know Rajoy gave a speech saying, like, we are still going to be pursuing these people to bring them to justice, people who have violently murdered and attacked and terrorized people for so many years. It actually kind of reminded me of the Bosnian war criminal who drank poison in court back in November. He was like staging his own death in a way that didn't allow proper closure. And I guess in some ways you could argue that ETA being allowed to announce with this like pomp and circumstance that they are closing could be seen as like making it more difficult for the families of the victims to get closure, because people think, oh, that's done now.
Yeah, and that was one of the main things that victims groups have said, is that even though ETA apologized last month for all the bloodshed caused, they didn't really feel like the apology was a proper one, because it kind of made a distinction between people that got caught up accidentally in the violence and kind of what they would consider to be legitimate targets, like police officers, for example. And they said that there's loads of unsolved crimes that ETA hasn't come forward to explain as well. For families of the victims, there's probably never going to be that kind of closure. But all in all, I think we can still call it a good week for peace in Europe.
I agree. I guess it's time for bad week. I promise we're not being secretly sponsored by IKEA, but I would understand why you might think we are, because we keep mentioning them both on this podcast and when we appear on other people's podcasts lately, we keep talking about IKEA.
Because it's really European. I was right the whole time.
Apparently it's really European. Yeah, anyway, to relieve your suspicions, we are giving the position of bad week to IKEA. So we're definitely not sponsored by them, because they would not be happy with that. So this week they were exposed as cultural appropriators for one of their most iconic products, the supposedly Swedish meatballs. Now, the official Twitter account for the country of Sweden spontaneously tweeted the following last week. Open quote. Swedish meatballs are actually based on a recipe King Charles XII brought home from Turkey in the early 18th century. Let's stick to the facts! Exclamation point. Close quote.
Oh my God. Sweden is built on a lie.
It really is, yeah. So this King Charles, he was handed the throne at the age of 15 in 1697. He spent some years in exile in Turkey, and he brought the recipe for meatballs back with him when he returned to the country a few years before his death in 1718. Didn't live very long, poor guy. Anyway, it's good that justice has been done for Turkey, and it seems that IKEA hasn't responded to the scandal yet, but I imagine they won't be quite as concerned as when it was discovered back in 2013 that there was horse meat in their meatballs.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that was in the original Turkish recipe, but nonetheless, IKEA, you get a bad week, even if you're not responding to the story.
Do you think then that Turkey should get royalties every time I go to IKEA and eat a plate of meatballs?
Well, there are some Turkish people who were like actually genuinely quite angry about it, saying like IKEA need to apologize and shouldn't be benefiting. You laugh, but it's cultural appropriation and it pisses people off.
It isn't. I laugh because this is like 300 years ago and food spreads across borders. And I kind of feel like after 300 years, it's not cultural appropriation anymore.
Ooh.
Controversy on the Europeans.
Where do you draw the line?
The other thing is that I don't think the way that the Swedish king guy took the meatballs was like an act of aggression or anything. I think he just kind of like brought them back as a recipe, and that's how recipes spread. It's more like cultural spread than appropriation.
Cultural spread makes it sound like it's not butter.
Delicious cultural spread.
I don't think I know enough about the situations in which he was living in exile in Turkey and to what extent he was exploiting the people that he was staying with. So I'm not willing to comment on that.
But also, if you feel like that about food, then you can't eat things like coronation chicken, because that's like evil colonial food.
Oh my God, this reminds me of our wonderful interview with the Michelin-starred chef, Christian Puglisi.
Did we talk about coronation chicken?
No, but we talked all about cultural appropriation of food. That's what it was about.
It's true. Listeners, go back and listen to that if you want to hear a fascinating discussion of like food and borders. It was, which week was it? March 27th.
I clearly didn't learn anything because I'm still making the same mistakes and claiming that food should have borders.
I think it's nice to have debates about these things. But I'm prepared to die on this hill. Let Sweden keep the meatballs.
Well, before Katie goes into battle with whichever European country, we should go and speak to Daniel Gould, who's currently spending time with lots of Europeans who are battling each other with the power of song and lights and campery.
I got a little bit emotional when I realised it was nearly Eurovision time, because it was about this time last year that we were starting to talk about setting up this podcast. And I just remember going to watch the Eurovision semi-finals with you in a bar in Amsterdam. And not to get too mushy or anything, but it was like one of the first times that I ever really felt properly European as an identity. It just felt like, what an amazing thing. There's this terrible, terrible pop music competition every year, like truly dreadful. And all around the continent, people are sitting with their friends and their families watching it and laughing at it. And I still think it's one of the very few shared cultural experiences that we have as a continent.
Oh my God, Katie, the fact that you just called it terrible, I think we're going to have to bring that up with Daniel and see what he says about that.
It is terrible. I bet even Dan would recognize that. Come on, it is terrible. Don't you remember the Swedish one last year?
Obviously, some of them are terrible, but don't you remember the Portuguese winner last year? I thought he was a really good songwriter, or him and his sister.
We love the Portuguese entry from last year. The other memory I had from Eurovision last year, when I stopped feeling so mushy about the whole thing, was, do you remember when I set fire to my coat during the finals?
No.
You and Thomas were sitting on the other side of the bar, but it was really crowded. And suddenly I was just like, I can smell burning. There's this weird burning smell. And I feel really warm, and turned around and the back of my coat was on fire because I'd sat on the tea light. I could have died.
Oh, you really could have. It could have. This podcast could never have happened.
So much could have been different. Anyway, moving on from that macabre moment, let's give Mr. Gould a call, as we've decided to call him.
I'm going to call him Mr. Gould for the whole interview. Do you think that's okay?
Given that he literally used to be your teacher, I think that's very appropriate.
Mr. Gould, Daniel Gould, he runs a website called sofabet.com, and it's a website in which he writes about the betting markets for X Factor and Eurovision, and I think some other UK television programs as well sometimes. It's become quite a huge market, the Eurovision betting market, and he comes from a background of horse race betting, but also was my politics teacher, so has a history and politics background with a focus on Europe. So he's like the perfect person to make money from Eurovision. And I think he makes quite a lot of money. I am super excited to speak to him about it and find out like how this happened. Hello, Mr. Gould.
Hello there. How's it going, Dominic?
Fine. Very well, thanks. Long time no see. I'll have to try and stop myself calling you Mr. Gould.
And sir would be even worse, obviously. Yeah.
Mr. Gould, it's really nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to talk about the things I love, so I'm very happy to do so.
Can I start by asking you, like, how did this happen? One day you were my politics teacher, and then the next day I found you on Twitter talking about X Factor and Eurovision betting markets.
That's right. So when I was growing up, my dad used to take me horse racing. So I was a bit of a teenage form student, studying the form and betting a little bit as well. And then when I was a student, I liked watching cheesy TV shows like Stars in Their Eyes and Eurovision. And I was always pretty good at working out who was going to win. So I just put the two together, and I was doing the betting on the side while I was teaching. Uh-huh. And it just reached a point where I was lucky enough to have a good few years, and I reached a point where I was actually making more money doing that than I was my annual teaching salary. So that's when I decided to make the switch and ditch the day job.
You're quite sort of hardcore Eurovision nut, is that fair to say?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've been at the press centre every year since 2011 for the whole 2 weeks of rehearsals. So I took a kind of approach to Eurovision betting that I had taken to horse racing betting, which was to study the form, spreadsheets with voting patterns.
So how many of your decisions are based on like the geopolitical movements within Europe?
Less so than it used to be, because there are juries involved in every single country now that have a 50% say. So that has changed the emphasis somewhat. It used to be in the mid-noughties that diaspora, like say the Turkish diaspora or the Armenian diaspora, all phoning up 20 times each for their particular country, you know, with that focus on that one act would help them win or come second in the televote in certain countries. Actually, we've really reached an era where song quality and performance quality matters far more than anything else.
That presumably doesn't count for the UK, who will still never win anymore,
hey,
will they?
That's because we send terrible songs and or terrible performers. This year we've got she's an okay performer. She's got a terrible song.
Ooh.
And she will be bottom five in the final.
I thought it wasn't terrible. Well, I thought it sounded like if you were on a lot of drugs, it wouldn't sound terrible.
Right, so the thing is that it's not necessarily the worst song in the final that finishes last. It's the blandest song that no one has any motivation to pick up their phones to vote for. So if something is terrible but has funny costumes or is comic or something, you will get some votes. If you've got something that is just passes you by because it's so middle of the road, it's painful, then that won't get any votes. So in the last couple of years, Germany have sent like radio-friendly options which just kind of pass you by for 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And they've ended up finishing last twice and second last on the other occasion.
I remember Germany being very boring last year.
Exactly. And we've sent a song this year that sounds like it could be the German entry from the last couple of years. Put it like that.
Oh. Zing. So you've been in Lisbon for the last couple of weeks watching the rehearsals like a hawk. What exactly are you looking for, and what has really stood out for you this year?
I always describe it as a Eurovision star contest as well. It's not just about song. It's about someone who zings off the stage and through the screen and grabs the people watching at home. So people have got 26 songs to get through. You want to create that one moment and be that one character they remember. And the last 2 years have been good examples of that. So last year we had Salvador from Portugal, who was in the press beforehand because he was having heart problems. He's actually had a heart transplant in the last year. And he was a very individual performer with these nervous tics. And he had this beautiful old school jazzy song that felt like it represented Portuguese culture, which really appealed to both the televoters and to jury members who are trying to look credible and credit something that's got artistic merit. And the same thing happened the year before when the Ukraine's Jamala gave a searing performance, and the staging was wonderful with the tree being revealed, the roots coming out of her body onto the screen behind her.
Sorry.
And she kind of talked about babies being killed and cradled a baby in her arms and sung with such passion. And there you had it again. You had something that really represented where she was from, told a story, and she showed great artistry in the process. And people remembered her as a character and that tree as a moment.
I just wanted to clarify, I wasn't just laughing at the Ukrainian war there. It's just like, I love all the like drama around the staging of Eurovision, how ludicrous it is. But if we were to push you at this stage in the game, Daniel, for your favourites, tentative favourites right now, would you be able to give us a few names?
Yeah, so Israel would come top of my list, absolutely. So they're sending an iconic character, someone who could very much follow in the footsteps of Conchita, Jamala and Salvador. And her name is Netta. Now, Netta is a young female and she's oversized and proud. She says, look at me, I'm a beautiful creature. And she is. And she has a couple of amazing skills. She uses a looper, where she samples her own live vocals just as she's singing them. She's also an amazing vocalist on the big notes. And she's got a song which is about female empowerment. It's been connected to the Me Too movement. Ooh. It's very poppy. The lyrics of the chorus go, "I'm not your toy, you stupid boy."
Nice.
And it's done with these Eastern kind of instrumental flourishes. So you really get a sense that it is from Israel. And she's using, she loves K-pop and Japanese pop and influences. And so visually, she's wearing a kind of kimono type affair. And she's got the lucky cats with the paws sort of waving in cabinet cases behind her as she performs. So the whole thing is incredibly unique and individual.
Will she not lose some points for culturally appropriating the Japanese?
Oh, not this again.
That is a thing that has been mentioned. There's also talk that if she's from Israel, does that mean some jury members from some countries are less inclined to vote kindly for Israel? And, you know, ultimately, the whole point of Eurovision, which is so wonderful about it, and especially in this era when the radical nationalist voices are being heard, is that Eurovision is when the whole of the continent can actually come together and prove that, you know, we cultural exchange is important. That would be my response to people who have accused Netta of cultural appropriation, is to say that actually Eurovision is about cultural exchange. And this year, for example, it's not just Netta. The Estonian entry is an Italian opera song. Is that cultural appropriation? She's not facing those same
no, it's true.
Calls.
So have you had to like train yourself up musicologically?
I don't pretend to be something that I'm not. I look at it in layman's terms and I describe it in layman's terms because that's how people will vote for stuff. You know, the lay viewer at home who has no music training is going by, oh, I like this, or I like her, or I like him. I'm picking up those things rather than getting too hung up on too many things. Although I do know a musicologist who's very savvy on which keys do well at Eurovision.
Wow.
Oh, cool.
D minor is the best. And there's also a BPM that's also, you don't really want to go over 128, and Netta is at 130 in terms of BPM.
Oh, no way.
So it's nice. Your sofa bet has introduced me to people who know more about music than I do.
How much of your own money do you bet on this every year, Daniel, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, a lot. It's my bank is a six-figure sum. Let's put it like that. The market's always changing, like a stock exchange. And I'm, like, for months on end, for 3 or 4 months, I'm just always looking at the market and always taking prices. And so literally the bets I do run into the tens of thousands. And I should say it's not just about one market. It's not just about the win market. There's the top three, top four, top five, top ten, last place, semi-final qualification, semi-final winner, top Balkan country, top Eastern country, etc., etc.
That was amazing. I have learned so many things. Like, Eurovision for me has always just been people in stupid glittery clothes singing terrible songs on TV, but this has opened my eyes to this whole industry that exists around it. It's fascinating.
It's amazing. But I also think he knows so much about it that the UK should employ him to like create or manage the most like wonderful, perfect Eurovision song. Because I feel like he knows so much about it that he could do that.
D minor, 127 beats a minute.
Yeah.
Done, sorted. I felt really bad because I started giggling when he started talking about the Ukrainian lady with the tree. But it's just the staging in Eurovision. It gets me so giggly every year that I just couldn't help it.
Yeah, it was a really emotional song about like the death of her family members and stuff. So I think that's really inappropriate.
I know. Sorry, everyone. Staying in Southern Europe, we're going to go over to Spain now. Spain's been in the grip of a kind of new version of the Me Too movement in recent days. There have been tens of thousands of women sharing stories, often horrific stories of rape and sexual abuse, under the hashtag Cuéntalo, which means tell it. This was all spurred on by the horrific case of this young woman in Pamplona who was attacked in 2016 during the bull running festival by a gang of men. And last week, they were all found not guilty of gang raping her. Just to avoid any doubt, these 5 men had non-consensual sex with this woman. They filmed it, and one of them shared it in this quite sickening WhatsApp group, which became very notorious. It was called the Wolf Pack. And instead of getting convicted of rape, they were found guilty of this lighter, lesser offence of sexual abuse. They got 9 years in prison each instead of 22, which is what the prosecutors wanted. It sparked this whole national debate in Spain over sexism and sexual consent.
I just don't understand how the courts could say that you have to, there has to be actual violence other than sexual violence for it to be, in order for it to be rape.
Right.
The defendants focused on the fact that she was passive and had her eyes closed and didn't fight back.
Which I'm absolutely sure is because she was terrified out of her wits.
Absolutely.
We have on the line one of the people who's at the forefront of Spain's feminist movement, Brigitte Vassallo. She is a writer and activist. And that's actually the first question we're going to ask Brigitte, is what this case says about the way that sexual consent is understood in the Spanish court system.
We have this picture that the victim of raping is somebody who is going to fight and is going to cry and is going to scream. And we don't fight. I mean, you are raped, you want to save your life in that moment. I think sexual consent, it's a problem that is not only going on laws and how laws think about consent and raping, but it's a social issue. All the movies and the literature and the music, we have a lot of scenes of raping, of non-consensual sex. They are completely normalized. The picture also of what is a woman who's been raped is also a picture of an eternal victim. Myself, I've been raped, but I'm not a raped woman. I'm a woman and I have plenty adjective to talk about me, but I'm not a raped woman. I've been raped. And that's it. What is happening new now in Spain with this last case is that society is so fed up and is saying stop. I mean, this is not fair and this is not okay.
I mean, obviously, it's a universal problem between men and women. But do you think that there's a problem with machismo and the patriarchy more so in Spain than there is in like other surrounding European countries?
No, I don't think Spain is having a special problem with machismo issue. I think sexism is everywhere, but it's easier to see it in others than in ourselves. For example, in Spain, the question would be all the time that Muslims has a problem with machismo culture, or also does Latinos has a problem with machismo culture. There is this myth that we think that the others are always more sexist than we are. Also, I think it's important to point that raping is not an issue about men and women. There is plenty of men who are being raped when they were children. Also, men are raped when they are adults by other men. So it's basically a problem of power.
One of the issues that's come up a lot recently in this Cuéntalo movement, the online outpouring of stories about abuse, is this issue of femicide, women being killed. Spain, I think, has one of the lowest rates of crimes against women being reported. I just wondered, why do you think that is? Or maybe it's just chance, I don't know. But do you think there are any kind of more structural reasons for why that is?
Actually, since I work a lot on that, I have plenty of women reporting to me that they've been raped in the last times, but they didn't go to the police because they don't want to go through this social judgment. Or maybe the rapists, they're going to be out in 1 year. There are plenty of stories that we don't know because we don't talk about them. And for example, this thing, this Cuéntalo that we saw on Twitter the last weeks, it's a way of reparation. When you see that you are not alone, that it's not only to you that this happened, that this is happening to all of us. When you survive, there is a kind of shame that is not my particular experience, but I've been talking with other women. And somehow we say, I'm not the one who has the right to talk about that because my raping was not that bad. And all rapings are so bad. I mean, I've been raped for 3 men. I mean, it's bad enough to talk about that. But still, we think we are not victim enough. We all have to explain our stories, but at the same time, we all have right not to talk about that if it's not the moment.
There's quite a lot going on in Spanish feminism right now. There's all this stuff around Cuéntalo. And back in March, millions of Spanish women went on strike for International Women's Day. Is Spain going through some kind of feminist awakening right now?
Let's not forget our history. We've been in a dictatorship until 1975 with very, very, very hard gender rules. I think feminism is going mainstream. I'm very happy. Of course, the feminism that is going mainstream is the easier one in the sense of the less risky one, the less threatening one. But it's okay. It's a beginning. I mean, we need the less threatening one to be able to have also the threatening feminism. And I think it's good that it goes mainstream. I'm happy that men also are discovering that this is not going fine and we need to change it. I'm happy that young girls, that they are 14 or 13, as we said the last 8 March, they are going out with very hard words and sentences, and they are very young girls. I was so happy. So I don't know if officially we are going through a feminist awakening, but I really hope that is happening like this.
That was a hopeful note to end what could have been quite a gloomy subject to talk about. But to keep cheering you up, I'm going to give you my happy ending.
Oh, no.
Feels a bit inappropriate to talk about a happy ending.
It's very much consensual.
Here's my happy ending. This week's happy ending is very happy for anyone who loves Harry Potter, Katie.
Oh, that's me. That's me.
And anyone who loves the British royal family, Katie?
Well, not so much, but go on. You've piqued my interest.
Potter maniacs online have suggested that there is quite a magical link between the name of the newest member of the British royal family, Prince Louis Arthur Charles. Have you heard about this, Katie?
Oh, yeah, somebody mentioned this to me, but I can't quite remember the details, so go on.
Okay, well, you're clearly not a good enough Potter fan. Hey. Anyway, so Prince Louis Arthur Charles, like many other aristocrats and royals, he has three names, which is very... No, anyway.
I've got two middle names.
You've got two middle names?
And I am decidedly not posh. I grew up above a shop.
Oh my God, you're so aristocratic.
Really am.
I've only got one.
Oh, that's almost aristocratic in its own way, though, you know?
Oh, thank you.
It's like Prince or Madonna.
Cher. I was thinking more Cher. Anyway, it's been noticed that all three of his names are names of members of the Weasley family. Now, if you don't know who the Weasley family are, it might be because you read it in a language other than English. In Dutch, they are the Vemel family. In Norwegian, the Vitterson family. And in Ukrainian, the Visley family. If you still don't know who they are, then don't worry about it. This happy ending will be over very quickly, I promise. And go and read some Harry Potter. So Arthur Weasley is the Weasley dad from the books. Charles Weasley is the second son. And Louis Weasley is the more obscure one. He is the youngest son of Fleur and Bill and doesn't even feature in the books, but was discovered when J.K. Rowling published a family tree and she included him in it. So anyway, that's that. Happy news for the Kate and Wills and all the Harry Potter fans in the world.
Do we think that's why they did it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
No, I think it's probably a coincidence because, like, they're a pretty enormous fictional family if you look at the family tree. So it's not that difficult for a child to be named with three names from that family.
There was a lot of excitement in my office in Paris when it was announced that the baby was going to be Louis because it's a French name. And all these cries of like, oh, c'est un garçon! And everyone got super excited.
Really? Serious journalist people got excited about it.
Serious journalist people. I mean, French people don't like to admit this, but because they kill their own royals, they really like following ours. A lot of French people, even who are like quite hardened Republicans, will be like, oh, so the wedding. And they love chatting about it. And I find it hilarious and amazing.
I'm actually quite excited about the wedding too.
Are we fans of Meghan on this podcast? I think we are, aren't we?
I'm a huge fan of hers. I used to watch Suits, and I don't think she's like the best actor, but I did find her rather entrancing.
Oh, what, you're like into her?
No, I don't like fancy her, but I just think she's got like some charisma about her.
Okay, I'm sure she'd say the same about you, Dominic.
Anyway, before we just make this a podcast about Harry Potter and the royals, we should probably leave you for the week and Katie should go and find out if we've won the Charlemagne Prize.
I should. And I've also got to go and brush up on my Eurovision and go and watch all of the entries for this year. Oh my God, I've just had a genius idea.
What?
The Arkan Awards are on Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
Eurovision's on Saturday. So I was thinking, if we win any money, we should gamble it all as per Dan's advice and double our money.
Oh my God, we can more than double the money, Katie. Come on, what kind of gambler are you?
A reserved and pragmatic one. Okay. But think about it, we could be rich. Is that a good idea?
Let's do it. Yes, very good idea. Okay.
Maybe not. In case anyone from the European Commission is listening to this, I am obviously joking, but I might put like €5 of my own money on it.
I'm not sure actually we are legally allowed to bet, but I think that you're like allowed to do anything with the money apart from gamble it.
On Eurovision.
Yeah. Thank you to our wonderful guests this week, and you can find us on Twitters at EuropeansPod.
And Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. By the way, following up from your mentioning last week that Donald Tusk is now there, I'm really enjoying his posts.
Are you? I found them a bit banal.
Oh, I'm getting a little bit into Donald. It's just a thing I'm doing at the moment. Anyway, I'm going to leave now and go and look at Donald Tusk's Instagram. Have a lucky week, Europe, and may the odds be forever in your favour. Adios.
Adios.